1209, a green screen is always a good thing to see on the Business Lunch, the Wintrust Business Lunch. Hi, it's John Williams. I'm here weekdays from 9 to noon and noon to 1 on the Business Lunch on WGN Radio. I mentioned just before the news at noon something we'll do tomorrow. It's a conversation with a guy who is in the promotional import-export business. If you get promotional pens or ball caps for your conventions, that's his trade. There's not a lot of conventions going on. He transitioned to importing and exporting PPEs, masks, sanitizers, health aid products that we're all scrambling for. He's selling them at close to his cost. I don't think this is a profiteer, but it's somebody who had already arranged relationships with people that make these things in China, and he already has schemes to get them to and from the United States. His minimum order was 1,000 the last time we talked to him a couple of weeks ago. He's lowered it to 250 units. I say all of that to say I know a lot of businesses are thinking, okay, when we go back to work, we're going to want gloves. We're going to want masks. We're going to want whatever we can to make our employees feel safe. How am I going to get ramped up for that? On tomorrow's show, he'll join us to talk about what he's doing, how he's transitioned his business, and how it might help yours. By the way, you have all of these sorts of packages that are out from the federal government coming to you in Chicago and in the state of Illinois. In fact, some of them are coming from the state itself. There's one program to help small businesses. They received 7,000 applications in the first week. Amy Guth is going to talk about this later in this broadcast. Chicago's $100 million loan program for small businesses. $100 million there. And in the first couple of days, 7,000 businesses applied for it. And so far, they have filled how many of them? 10. 10 of them have been approved. The point is that while the money is there, it is very difficult for these organizations, these banks, these programs at the city to meet the need. And then there's the whole problem of trying to figure out what is out there to begin with. I hope it did not slip through the cracks for you that there is also in these stimulus packages educational loan relief, so that if you have money that you've borrowed or your kids or grandkids have borrowed to go to school, maybe they've graduated now and you're making those monthly payments. Well, that's a hard pill to swallow right now, isn't it? Ray Kaplan is on a phone line to answer a couple of questions about the relief that's there for them. Hi, Ray. How are you? Good afternoon.
Hi, John. I'm great. How are you doing?
Really good. You're an attorney. You specialize in college debt and relief. What's in the package to help people who have borrowed for school?
Well, this is a really great package. It was signed by the president on March 27th, and essentially, what it says is that if you have federal student loans, in other words, loans where the borrower is the Department of Education, which applies to most federal student loans, then you are eligible automatically for a six-month suspension of payments. And you really don't have to do anything in order to get this. It's not like you have to apply for it and go through a whole bunch of red tape. So your listeners should know that if you have loans from the Department of Ed, they will automatically be suspended, and the interest will also be suspended. So no interest will accrue on the loans from March 13th, so it's a little bit retroactive, March 13th through September 2020. Now, this does not apply to private student loans. It only applies to federal student loans. The other question people usually have is if they're on track to get public sector loan forgiveness, will the $0 payments count towards public sector loan forgiveness? And the answer is yes. The one thing you still need to make sure, and we can help you with this, is to make sure that you are in an approved payment plan, even if it is going to be the $0 per month for the next 6 months. So this is really fantastic because a lot of our clients, and in fact, some of the employees even at our office, have monthly student loan payments that are $1,500 a month. And so this six-month break from payments without any interest accruing is really, really, I think, very helpful.
It's not outright forgiveness, though, right? The 6 months would be added at the back end of the loan?
No, it's not added at the back of the loan. It's just a complete suspension. with no interest accruing.
So, in fact, it is 6 months of payments that you don't have to make.
Exactly.
Well, suppose I could make the payments. I hate to say this, but maybe I don't even have to, even if I have. There's no litmus test for who is applies?
No. So the only thing is that the loans have to be owned by the Department of Education. So the main thing is that they have to be, they can't be FFEL loans, which a lot of people have federal family education loans as opposed to direct loans. So that's the only thing that, you know, might throw a monkey wrench in there. But as long as you have direct subsidized, unsubsidized Stafford loans, even if you're on automated payments, they'll actually turn off automated payments for these 6 months so that people don't even have to go through kind of the rigmarole of turning off the automatic payments.
Right.
So it's great. But I'm sorry, you asked me a question. I don't think I answered it.
I think you did. And if you here's the deal. I'm sure that having heard that, our listeners have a lot more questions and comments. Your website is debtrelief.com.
It's financialrelief.com.
Financial. How many times have I said that?
I know.
Can you believe I got that wrong? Financialrelief.com. I know the phone number is 312-294-8989. Financialrelief.com. Call or text, email, go to their website. That's Ray Kaplan of the Kaplan Law Firm. Nice to talk to you. Thanks for your help, Ray.
Thanks so much, John. Bye-bye.
It's 1219 on WGN Radio. This is John Williams. On a phone line, Ian Scherer joins us now, editor-at-large at CNET News. Ian, it's John Williams. Welcome to WGN. How are you today?
I'm all right. How are you?
Pretty good. Probably interesting, challenging times for the likes of you these days, eh?
Challenging times. But, you know, what's interesting, I think, is that the tech industry is taking this opportunity after being, you know, taking it on the chin over the last couple of years for privacy issues and, you know, election interference and all sorts of other stuff, and trying to really do some good. Whether or not they are is a debatable thing, but they're at least trying.
Oh, I think that this has been a turning point, maybe a pivot point, let's say, for digital technology, for tech companies, and I have a good feeling about them generally. You're hinting at something that I'm unaware of.
Well, I mean, I think the challenge for them, right, is that we have examples where Facebook and Google, in particular, are trying to use the masses of data that they collect on us to tell us stuff like Google, for example, earlier this week showed off a tool that they created to show whether or not people in different countries were actually following the stay-at-home orders. And they did this by collecting data on our phones. We all, you know, if you have a Google app on your phone, whether it's Gmail or Google Maps, oftentimes you give them access to your location data. Well, they can use that, and they know where your home is because you're constantly using Google Maps, so they're able to tell whether you're leaving home. And they put this out. They put it on their website. They showed which countries were better than others and which states were worse than others. I'm not going to give any side eye to any certain states, but you can guess. And one of the things that was really challenging about it was that a lot of people said, okay, so what are we supposed to do with this data? What's the use of it? You know, it's great that you were able to show us that you can collect all this information and put it in this nifty little graph, but is it going to be something that you're going to update in real time? Is it something that you're going to hand over to health professionals? Is it something that you're going to give further detail to? And, of course, Google didn't have any answers. So a lot of people looked at that and said, well, that's just a big PR stunt. It's not actually helping anyone.
Yeah.
So that's the challenge that I think the tech industry goes into. Whereas, by comparison, Apple, they recently showed off that they made some 20 million masks to help with protection of the doctors, and they came up with a way to ship them flat so they can put more into a box and all that. And so far, reaction to that's been really positive. So there's an example where Apple is using its massive size to everyone's benefit. But it's a challenge, right? Every company's different, and how they handle this stuff is very different as well.
I wouldn't mind if they had that geo information and they made it available to Lori Lightfoot or J.B. Pritzker and said, you guys need to know if people are more mobile than they should be. I get your point, though, about just throwing it out there and then people either shame other people or do who knows what with that information, right?
Right, and it's anonymized, so it's not actually particularly helpful for people who are in government, because government wants to find out the people who are doing this badly, but then, you know, Google looks bad because it's turned into a surveillance technology, right? So these are really challenging issues, and they've always been a problem, but stuff like this really brings it to the fore, which I think is a really fascinating issue.
Ian Scher is on a phone line. He is the editor-at-large at CNET. This is WGN Radio. By the way, the Dow's up 495 points right now. We're just under 24,000 at 23,927. By the way, what is the status? The president had announced, seems like forever ago, a couple of weeks ago, that Google was going to have a site people could go to for real-time information about the coronavirus, and then that stalled. Is that happened, or is that going to happen?
Yeah, so that was definitely a big drama within the tech industry, because even Google was not fully aware of what the president was announcing. So that's a challenge right there. But there is a website they have. If you go to Google's website, there's a little click on the bottom for information about the coronavirus, and that certainly does have more information. But part of the idea behind it was that it could also help people figure out where they could get testing, which is an ongoing issue, as we all know. Well, Google really hasn't been able to solve that, because in a lot of ways, it hasn't been solved on the county and state level.
Right.
So as a result, the website is there mostly as an information thing. It's very similar to what, for example, the CDC did with Microsoft. They have an app on their website, which we wrote about on CNET, where you can actually tell it what your symptoms are, and it'll tell you, hey, you're probably okay, or hey, you should go see a doctor. And that's really helpful. But, you know, the challenge, I think, is that the tech industry, when President Trump was talking about it, was going to help set up these testing facilities and scheduling and organizing it all, and that really hasn't happened. But I wouldn't blame the tech industry. It seems to be more of a government problem, although I don't know for sure.
Well, and to that, the government has said, the president and our own governor here in Illinois, that we've been aspirational. So where the president thought, let's do this and go for it, it doesn't happen. He said yesterday, again, I'm a cheerleader. I was telling you what we should be reaching for. And in Illinois, right, J.B. Pritzker had a press conference yesterday and said, well, we'd hoped to have 10,000 and we promised we would test a day. We're at 6,000. And here's why. The testing program isn't working as well as we had hoped. By the way, along those lines, Instacart is providing health and safety kits to its shoppers. Tell me how that's working.
Yeah, it's something that we're starting to see more and more of, is that the people who are in the gig economy, so it's Instacart, Uber, Lyft, all these things, they are on the front lines of all this, right? They are the people who are bringing us our food. They are the people who are shuttling us to the hospital if we have to, and all that type of stuff. So one of the things that's been a real challenge for these companies is, of course, that these companies up until now have not treated these people like employees. You know, they're legally contractors. They're not employees. And as a result, these companies are not used to giving them stuff like health care or even worrying about their safety very much. Well, now that's starting to change a little bit. Instacart is going to provide masks and safety kits with a thermometer and some hand sanitizer to a number of its employees. Mostly, this is going to be to those shoppers that they have that are full-time. So if you're one of the people who's a part-time shopper, sorry, Instacart's not going to be able to help you for now. But at least Instacart's trying to show that they're trying to help. And, you know, one of the things I think that's been really interesting is that as you listen to a lot of the debate within the tech industry, Amazon workers, for example, have been starting to protest because they've been getting sick inside the warehouses, and they feel like Amazon's not doing enough to sanitize, to fix the problems, to make sure the people who are sick are actually taken care of, yeah, all those types of things. So it's interesting to see Instacart at least try to step up a little bit.
That's sort of boots on the ground, but I'm thinking about Zoom too, which has this digital problem. And in each case, I wonder, how fair is it to criticize businesses that could not have anticipated the scope of need that they're now challenged with?
It's a challenge, definitely. I mean, look, there are a lot of companies out there who are seeing massive increases in usage. I mean, Google, for example, they have a story we wrote on CNET about how they are seeing more than 2 million people a day sign up for their video chat service. We've seen that Microsoft Teams, which is a competitor to Zoom, has grown substantially And Zoom, of course, itself has become kind of a cultural touchstone all of a sudden. But the challenge, I think, and why we at CNET continue to report on the number of security problems they have, that's one thing that's been happening called Zoom bombing. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but basically, yeah, so what happens is that school districts who might have, like, an open meeting, right, they'll put the link on Twitter or Facebook or on their site, or even religious organizations, right? A lot of congregations will have Zooms for their congregations. Well, people will sign up and join because anyone can join, and suddenly in the middle of it, they'll throw up pornography, or in the case of some Jewish organizations, people have been putting swastikas up. And it's just kind of one of those things where if Zoom had really thought through a lot of their security issues, or even the way that you set up your Zoom, right, and to be able to set it up so that only certain people can join, or that you can easily control what they do, or whether or not they can share their screen. But the company didn't really set up for a lot of that stuff, and that doesn't matter how many people are using it. A lot of it is just thinking through these problems. And now they're trying to solve it, right? They're coming up with new changes to their apps and whatnot, but it's all after we've all been pointing out these problems, and that's what we all kind of tend to focus on, is saying, look, it's great these companies exist. It's great that these apps are helping people, but these companies can't just throw something up and expect that everything's going to be happy-dory. You know, you really have to think through privacy, security, stuff that could really impact people down the line if you're not careful.
One last question. How are these tech companies handling the false videos that are put out there? There's all kinds of crazy conspiracy theories or curative theories. What's going on there?
Yeah, so this is really interesting because people like YouTube and Facebook and Twitter have been very, very, very unwilling to take stuff down. It's really rare for them to do that because they don't want to be accused of censorship. But when it comes to the coronavirus, it seems as though they are completely changing their tune. So particularly, there have been a number of conspiracy theories out there about how 5G wireless, right, the next generation wireless technology, somehow is causing the coronavirus. By the way, we have a story on CNET explaining how that's not even possible. The science doesn't back that up at all.
Yeah.
But it's something that continues to go around. So YouTube and Facebook are now actually taking those down. They're actually censoring them in a way that they've never really been willing to do before. And I'm really curious to see what that means in the future. How willing are they going to be to take down conspiracy theories that are patently false? And there's been a lot of them over the years that proliferate over these websites, right? It's not like coronavirus is the first.
No.
But now they're setting a precedent, and I'm really curious to see how it changes over time.
Visit CNET.com. Ian Scherer, editor-at-large over there. Always a pleasure. Thanks for your help, Ian.
Thanks for having me.
John Williams here. If you have a question along the way, maybe we can help. The number's 312-981-7200. Marty Constant's going to help us now. Welcome back to the show, Marty. You're on WGN. How are you?
Hello, John. Thanks for having me today.
We are. I've got a lot of questions for you, and I want to start maybe with the third one that you suggested to me. You're a workplace futurist and the author of a book called Activate Your Agile Career, which is available on Amazon. One of the things that you're talking about is business etiquette and how maybe it is changing if the nature of business meetings are changing. What do you see coming down the road as a result of all of this, Marty?
Two things, John. One is the absolute going to the online format for a lot of meetings. A little less travel and a little more personal is the shaking hands is going to go. And the hugging will not be at all accessible in the workplace.
So that's for a brick-and-mortar operation. That is, if we're still meeting in person, when we walk into the room, even the first time we've met, normally, of course, you shake somebody's hand. And maybe if you really know them, you might embrace them. Now, all physical contact, you think, going forward is going to be off?
I do think that. You know, think about it. We've been catching the flu and colds for decades, and we just assume that it has to be that way. But it doesn't have to be that way. It may be a little bit more of a hybrid in the future, but, you know, maybe the elbow bumps and touching the feet or bowing may be something we do in the future.
I was just playing an image of a group of people bowing to another group of people in my head and wondering what the new gesture is going to be. I think we have to have something. And if historically in the West it's shaking hands, what's the new gesture going to be? I don't know.
Yeah, well, you know, we started doing it while we were still meeting with doing the elbows, and that seemed to be working really well. People were having fun with it.
I wonder, though, too, if then we are going to meet online, say it's in a video conference chat, I wonder what the rules are. For instance, can I be eating? Do I have to have a necktie on? Is the background going to be controlled? How much attention do I have to pay? Is it okay to multitask? I suppose the business world's already confronted some of these, but it seems to me like these issues are going to be more acute going forward. Don't you agree?
They will be more acute, but the rules still stay the same. It's not polite to multitask and look at your device when you're in a meeting. You're not paying attention to the topic that's being addressed, that you were called to that meeting for a reason.
I've noticed that in real life anyway. I mean, I've been in meetings, personal and professional, where it's me and another person, but their phone is there. It feels like there's three people in the room, and that other person is always cutting in line. That's very annoying, right?
Right, right. So being in the moment, being present, and dressing for work is going to be the order of the day. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of jokes about, you know, people wear sweatpants on the bottom half of those things, and I guess you could still do that, but be present and dress professionally.
You're also saying that a lot more work is going to happen online, right?
Yes. The digital transformation has just escalated dramatically. We've crossed the chasm between what it was in January and what it is now. This would have naturally evolved over months and years, but there is a chasm that has been crossed because of COVID-19.
I wonder what you say about now or in the future, and I guess every businessman and woman out there can answer this themselves, but I wonder what the quality of work is digitally versus in person. Is it sometimes better to do it that way? Maybe people are more efficient. You lose time when you travel, if nothing else. Or do you just lose too much without the personal touch? Or is the work going to suffer for this?
I think work will be hybrid environments. I think the order of the day will be flexibility. So when you're working on a project and you need a lot of silence and focus, working from home on that day makes sense, and attending your meetings online while you're at home that day. When you are gathering in the workplace, you at least have a place to meet with clients, get together, and collaborate. So there's going to be a hybrid model. It's not going to be one or the other, but we're just going to make a lot more use of the digital experience.
You must know many people, like I do, who work from home exclusively or a lot, and swear that they're more efficient at home, even though there's no, you know, they could go for a jog, they could watch a TV show if they wanted, but they get more work done at home than they do in the office because there's much less social distractions, for one thing, at home than there is at the office.
Right. And one thing that we still do as human beings is many of us have had one-on-one virtual chats, almost like the socializing that happens in the workplace. We actually take a little break to do that for maybe 10 or 20 minutes during the workday, and you're able to reach out to somebody you normally don't chat with. We're becoming more comfortable with you know, working with other people and using their feedback to us as a way to, you know, be more creative in our work. And to have more flexibility to have those conversations.
I wonder too, Marty, are bosses telling their employees that are working at home now to close their computers at 5 or 6? I know a lot of people are putting in more hours now.
You know, they are. It's really interesting. I think people that I've talked to are working at least the amount of hours they were before, and they've deleted the commute. So the productivity has actually gone up. Are bosses telling their people that? I know some bosses are reaching out to have one-on-one calls with their people to say, how are you doing? I just thought I'd call to see how you're doing today. This is great behavior.
Something to think about for sure. One last note from you. Businesses are reinventing themselves, pivoting. I think we're talking a little bit about that. Do you have something else in mind along those lines?
People are bringing their work online, and some businesses are changing how they do what they do. Look at the distillery that's now making hand sanitizer. Will they always make hand sanitizer? Maybe yes, maybe no. But there's transformation going on.
A couple of things to think about. I appreciate your time. Futurist Marty Constant, her book is Activate Your Agile Career. You can get it on Amazon and hear her here on WGN. Thanks for your time, Marty.
Thanks so much, John.
1248 on WGN. WGN Radio Business Reporter Amy Guth joins us again. Hi, Amy. How are you?
Hey, John, doing well. Thanks. How's it going today?
Going well. Let's sort of buckle up here for some more, unfortunately, maybe bad information. Although, I don't know, the markets are coming up a little bit today. One wonders if we haven't bottomed out. But some of these numbers that you're looking at are tough. Another week of massive jobless claims I'm reading in the Tribune. What are you hearing about that today?
Yeah, that's right. I think one theme today really is about just the depth of the reach of, you know, the economic impact of the coronavirus on things. So the jobless claims right now, we're looking at 16.8 million claims over the last 3 weeks. 6.61 million were filed the week ending April 4th. So that's a really, really huge number. And of course, the Department of Labor releases those numbers on Thursday morning. So Thursdays are always kind of the day we get a look at how things are, how things feel and how they look for the economy. In Illinois, that's 201,000 people that applied for benefits in that same period. That's up from a little over 178,000 for the week prior. As we keep hearing about local rounds of layoffs and furloughs, you know, that kind of keeps our pulse on keeps a pulse on things of just how it's looking and how long this may go on. So for the 3 week total, what we're looking at then with these numbers is about a 13-14% unemployment rate, which is up from 10% at the peak from the last recession. So that's just a kind of keep a tab on where we are. That's already looking pretty significant there.
And you wonder, too, if maybe that's the number of people that have filed. Some folks have had trouble doing that. It's sort of like the cases of corona itself. You wonder if, in fact, the numbers are higher than what we're actually being told.
That's exactly right. A lot of unemployment offices have been reporting just being completely swamped and unable to keep up with demand. So I think we will see these numbers continue for a while.
Folks are not paying rent as much as they used to.
Yeah, this is really interesting. I've been watching, there's a lot of talk about a rent strike leading into April 1st. There was a lot more talk of people kind of posting to social media and making pleas with public officials to please, please put a delay on rent or at least delay evictions, things like that. So when we look at April 1st, who paid rent between April 1st and April 5th? So if someone paid after that, that's not included in this, but what we're looking at is only 69% of Americans paid rent, and that's data compiled by the National Multifamily Housing Council. They track a lot of different types of rental units, so they have a pretty good overview of things. That's up from the same period last year was 82%. The number of people who paid rent between March 1st and March 5th of this year, also about 81-82%. So that's a pretty average number. Most people do pay their rent the first couple of days of the rent. Some landlords, of course, say after so-and-so date, you can pay a little late if there's a fee, something like that. But we did see that number drop. Now, it remains to be seen what's going to happen in May 1st. We're looking at, you know, a lot of people waiting on stimulus checks, a lot of people trying to get their unemployment right. benefits sorted out. So there may be a little bit of a ramp up around some rent strike organizing or things like that leading into that May 1st rent date.
And that's for the first 5 days, you said. So April 1st, April 5th, maybe some people, maybe more people are going to pay on the 6th, 7th, today the 9th than normal, just because their cash is coming in later than it normally does.
That's exactly right. And it should be noted for in the federal stimulus package, anyone involved in federal subsidized housing, they can get aid and have a 120-day moratorium on evictions and late fees. But when we're talking about private landlords and tenants, that's where we get into this, you know, where people need to kind of work things out with a landlord if they're struggling and you know, have to kind of go the legal route in some cases.
We were talking a little while ago about how people are working at home, and I was just looking at the text line. Plenty of you are saying things like, John, I am much more efficient remotely. John, we have a group meeting every morning. How we're doing? What are we working on? The Microsoft team is the bomb for us. Some of you are having a lot of success working at home. People are traveling less. The numbers of folks that are traveling into Chicago recreationally or for business is way down. Hotels, what is the occupancy rate of hotels that you're seeing?
For the week ending March 29th, the occupancy rate was 7%. A year ago, it was 91%. So that is just a staggering number, 7%. And that's actually up. The week prior, it was 5.9%. So what that might mean is that that is kind of the bottom. We have hit sort of a low plateau of that. Of course, the biggest hits coming from convention business. McCormick Place and the Wintrust Arena have canceled 33 events that would have amounted to 533,000 hotel night stays, which is a very big number. So a lot of hotels have closed down completely. Some have decided to stay open with minimal staffing, but right now it's estimated that 75% of hotel rooms in the U.S. are empty.
We've been doing this for a month, and it's amazing to me how much time seems to have lapsed, but it's only been 4 weeks. Remember when the first big conventions were canceled in McCormick Place and we said, oh, really? And that was stunning. The houseware show isn't going to happen. That'll mean the loss of tens of thousands of dollars and 40,000 rooms. And now that's just so far on the horizon, I completely forgot about that. In fact, you would be shocked to hear a convention coming to town now. And yet 4 weeks ago, the idea that that would happen was really stunning. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. I keep having that same thought, and I've been, you know, taking so many notes and watching so many stories develop over the last 3 weeks, and I keep thinking, oh, wait, no, that was months ago. No, gosh, that was a week ago. It's interesting how time seems to move in a very different way right now, because I think so much is coming at us so quickly.
So I assume that the people that are, the 5 or 7% of the people that are in the hotels are paying probably a much lower rate than they normally would as well, huh?
That's right. There is some data looking at those hotel numbers. It's around $108 right now, average for downtown Chicago, which is, I think anyone who's ever booked a hotel room downtown Chicago knows that is quite a deal. So, you know, I think that there are really low rates just because I think hotels that are open really, really want to get people in those rooms. Of course, there is the program, too, where the city is working with some hotels to provide housing to first responders, to medical personnel who can't really go home and risk infecting their family after right. being around COVID-19 patients. So there's some hotels that are using that space and being subsidized by the city.
One last thing, Amy, I'm looking at a Chicago Business story about, and I mentioned this earlier, but I'm a little confused by this. So Chicago has a $100 million loan program for businesses, right?
Yes.
And is that's from Chicago? That's not the federal stimulus or federal bailout of businesses?
That is a separate one. That is the Small Business Resiliency Fund, and that is just focused here. Right now, there have been 7,000 applications since it opened on March 31st. As of last night, according to a city spokesperson, only 10 people have been approved for that. The same city spokesperson said, you know, we have really been overwhelmed. It was really a very short and simple statement that was kind of, the gist of it was kind of like, we're doing our best, we got overwhelmed. You have to question, hey, what did you think was going to happen? There's so many small businesses. Of course, a lot of people are going to apply for that. That's defined as a business with 50 or fewer workers and $3 million or less in annual revenue. So that applies to a lot of businesses, and it's a five-year loan up to $50,000. It's 1% interest for the first 18 months with minimal payments the first 6 months. So that's a really good deal if you need cash, you know, yesterday to deal with payroll and things like that. But these are just not going fast enough, very similar to the federal issues. So I think a lot of small business owners are really frustrated with both federal capacity and local capacity to get things done in a moment when they really need cash.
WGN Radio business reporter Amy Gu. Thanks, Amy. We'll visit again.
Thanks, John.